Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 21st, 2003. Today's session is entitled A Political Roadmap, Full of Roadblocks, Detours, and Walls. Session 1 of Roadmaps and Detours, Stories and Images from 5 Years in the Holy Land. It is presented by Susan and Michael Thomas. It is number THM 2003-06. Let's listen in.
How many of you were here last week? So, relatively few. Okay, today we're going to do an introduction to the week. First, we're going to introduce ourselves. I'm Michael Thomas.
I'm Susan Thomas.
And we've served as pastors of the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer in Jerusalem for the past 5 years. And prior to that, we served an ecumenical church, English language church in Vienna, Austria, and then we were in Cambridge, Massachusetts for 12 years. And I mention those prior experiences because those come into play in terms of a little game and question that we're going to talk about in a few moments.
I want you to know that what we served through the Division for Global Mission of the ELCA, and we were pastors in a church that was in the old city of Jerusalem. It was a congregation that that for our pastoral work was primarily internationals who were coming to work in the land there, often as teachers or with development agencies, and more recently with relief work. Most of the people in that congregation worked with Palestinians as the regular area of work, although there was connection with Israel as well, but mostly with Palestinians. And we lived in East Jerusalem, which is the East, the Palestinian section of Jerusalem. So our perspective is somewhat framed by that experience. We also work closely with Bishop Munir Younan of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, the Palestinian Lutheran Church there. And his offices were in our church building, and we would accompany him frequently as he visited congregations in the West Bank. So we have that kind of a connection as well.
Let me just say that when we lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, we served a university congregation and campus ministries at Harvard and MIT, BU, and Northeastern universities. And there, the turnover, the rotation, was every 4 years, more or less. And then, of course, in the congregation, there were people that had been in the congregation since its founding in the 1930s, actually. Then when we moved to Vienna, the rotation was about 3 years. Many United Nations staff and U.S. government and other embassy staff were members of the congregation, and they would rotate in and out every 2 to 3 years. And that was sort of the way it was when we came to Redeemer in Jerusalem, and then it sort of speeded up. Sometimes people were leaving rather quickly, depending upon what was happening on the ground. And then at least twice we had major evacuations where anyone connected with the U.S. government or some other governments were their dependents and non-essential staff or non-emergency staff, as they later became termed, had to leave. And so right before our first occasion was in 1998, just before the Christmas play, and all the Americans had to leave. And then fortunately that order was rescinded, I think, or some were able to.
Most people ended up staying.
Yeah, were able to stay. And the difficulty about leaving was you didn't know when you were coming back. Leaving in itself wasn't so bad because at Christmas time you could go home and visit the relatives. The difficulty was you didn't know when you'd be allowed back because that would be determined in Washington or in other capitals for other embassy or government personnel.
One of the really constant factors of our life there was that you would make plans, but you would never be able to count on those plans coming to fruition. And that was the case right from the start, from 1998 on, and it of course increased in 2000 when the Intifada began again, and there was conflict, actively violent conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians. And so what we will be hearing, talking about a lot this week, will be the way that you sort of are trying to get somewhere and your way is blocked. And last night's service used some of that imagery that we've been using, very obvious imagery and of trying to get somewhere and ways being blocked, and then how people have to deal with that by going around the blockage, by arguing their way through, all these kinds of things that were very standard for us.
During this week, we are here all week, and we'd be happy to talk with anyone over a meal or over coffee in more detail about our congregation. We could tell lots of stories about the congregation, and you will hear a few of those stories during the week, but we want to also try to cover a fair amount of material to try to give you a sense of what the Palestinian story is. I think most of us know, to at least probably more than superficial, a sense of the Jewish story. How many have seen movies dealing with the Holocaust, or read novels or works of history dealing, or in school? And we know that story. We know of the suffering. We know of the painful responsibility that Christians bear for the history of hatred towards Jews almost from the beginning. It was more complex in a way because the Christians were sort of on the outs at the beginning. But throughout the whole history of Christianity, there's been enormous enmity towards Jews in Europe. But do you know where Jews have not been persecuted throughout the last 2,000 years? Mostly in the Arab world. With Christians, they were considered people of the book, and they had to pay a special tax. They did not have all the responsibilities and privileges and rights that Muslim Arabs had, but they had a basic place in society along with Christians, and they were not persecuted. There were no pogroms, and there certainly was no Holocaust for Jews in the Arab world. That's important to keep in mind. We're going to play a little word association game now.
Okay, so let's just throw out what we think of when we use the word Palestinian. What?
Territory.
Territory, okay. What else?
God's land came to mind. God's land.
God's land. Palestinian land?
God's land.
Okay. People.
Pardon me?
People.
Palestinian people.
Yeah, and Jews in biblical times.
Right. Right now we're working with Palestinian, if we can stay with that.
But wasn't it called Palestine in
True.
Historical
okay,
times?
Okay. Palestine. Yeah, up through the British Mandate.
And for the most part, Jews were expelled during that time, beginning with the Romans.
Refugees?
Refugees, all right.
You want terrorists?
Terrorists, okay, I was waiting for that one. I expected that to be the first one in our minds. Okay. So you see that it's not completely negative. In fact, really, among these, you wouldn't necessarily have.
Aren't they Christian?
They are Christian. They are Christians. Yes. Not all of them. A very tiny percentage. How many do you think?
5%.
5%? Any other guesses?
Three.
Three?
Mm-hmm. In the last, in the at the end of the 19th century, there were about 13% of the population of Palestine, as it was called, or southern Syria, were Christians. And now it's somewhere between 1 and 2.5%.
Did they all leave?
So are they Muslim then, the others? Or?
The others are Muslim, yes. Yeah.
So did the Christians leave?
Many have left.
They just,
And the birth rate was different too, so relative to Muslim birth rate, but for the most part they left.
Let's use the word Israel. What do we think of?
Chairs.
Holy Lamb.
Jews.
Terrorizing.
You've been reading your news in a different way than many of us. Okay. Terrorizing.
Zionists.
Zionists, okay. Are people familiar with that term? Zionist has to do with the return to of the Jewish people from all of the diaspora of the Jewish people all over the world back to the state of Israel.
And also historically and politically to the creation of a Jewish state. It wasn't always thought that it was necessary that it be in Palestine. In fact, Herzl, the founder of the Zionist movement, thought about Madagascar and Uganda and decided that the most feasible place, and in some ways the most logical place, if you're thinking in those terms, would be Palestine.
I want to just put two words up here that are very difficult to hold together. Jewish state and democracy. If Israel is a Jewish state, it has to really manage its majority as of Jews in the population. And so it cannot let Arab Israelis with citizenship gain a majority to remain a Jewish state. And so it gets very complicated politically and very difficult to hold democracy and a Jewish state together.
How many Palestinians still live within Israel, the pre-67 borders of Israel?
About 1 million, it's 12%. We'll see that the percentage in just a few minutes. There are roughly, I think it's 1 million, there are 6 million Jews, or 6 million inhabitants of Israel, and 5 million are Jewish. 1 million, I think, are Palestinian.
This word surprised me that it came. What did you mean when you said that?
Bulldozing down homes.
Bulldozing homes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and shooting randomly into conclaves of people.
So that with the purpose of creating fear in the people so
also,
that they will...
And forcing settlements into the Palestinian mm-hmm. territory.
Okay. So maybe we should do that.
Okay. You are a tall person back there. Can you turn the power switch on the projector? It's right at the top of that white label.
Yeah. Top of here?
Yeah. Great. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about context, and I want us to think about what we see when we look out our bedroom window. When you awake in the morning, what do you see? What does your neighborhood look like? What does your community look like? I want us to think about context because it frames often how we also see reality. It frames what we in fact actually see and what we anticipate that we're going to see or what we hope to see. And it has to do with maps. We're going to see a lot of maps. And part of the reason that we're talking about context is because we want to introduce to you the Palestinian story or narrative or myth so that you can hold it alongside the Israeli story or narrative and realize that they're two stories. And if you come away with one thing today, I'd like it to be this, that what was a joyous event for the history of Jews in 1948 with the creation of the State of Israel and the return of people that have been decimated, more than decimated, since decimated really refers to a tenth of the population, had been cut at its root. Return of Jews to a state where they could have their own state was a great and joyous occasion for Jews and for many people around the world. The United States was the first country to recognize the State of Israel. What I want you to hold and keep in mind is that for Palestinians, it was a catastrophe. And they have a special word for it, al-Nakba, a catastrophe. And so you have, for one people, joy, and for another people on the same land, catastrophe, exile, dispossession. About 750,000 Palestinians were forced or chose to flee because they were afraid for their lives from Israel. And about 4 million refugees, 4 million remain refugees, obviously the descendants of those 750,000 people. And so the refugees are a big, major aspect of the whole question of the Middle East. But we're going to look at,
In terms of what Michael just said, it might be interesting to remember that the children of Abraham were Isaac from Sarah as the mother and Ishmael from Hagar. And if you recall the story of these two children, Isaac was the long-awaited child, and as there was a long period before he arrived, Ishmael was born by Hagar's handmaid, who was Egyptian. And Muslims trace their heritage to Abraham primarily through Ishmael. And so you have in that story of the joy that Sarah and Abraham felt over the birth of Isaac. And then, do you remember what happened in the story to Hagar and Ishmael? Cast out. They were cast out. And it's worth remembering that story as we think about this this whole situation. Ultimately, what happens for both is that the cast out.
Can you turn those lights off, please?
The cast out are not abandoned by God, either one.
And
a great nation
the other
comes
one,
from both.
And then that switch, please. Thank you. If some of you, last year we were here, and it seemed like I got up early many times. I haven't gotten up too early to see the sun coming over the mountains. But perhaps some of you do get up early enough, and this might be similar to the view out your bedroom window if you're facing toward the east, that beautiful bowl shape where that is adjacent to Holden Village. And that creates, you know, how you feel if you're up that early and you've gotten enough sleep and you know that you're going to have a cup of coffee soon. You know that the world seems full of possibilities and you can look forward to what you're going to be doing today. This is a view out our bedroom window in Jerusalem. This is at sunset. We would rise early, and we have Mount of Olives. We were on the Mount of Olives about halfway down, and so we couldn't see the sun rise. But what we could see was the sun coming from behind us as we sat in bed drinking coffee. We could see the sun strike those towers over here. This church tower right here is the Church of the Redeemer. That was our church. And work its way down, glinting off the Dome of the Rock and working its way down into the Kidron Valley. We always wondered what the day was like. And in the winter, it usually snowed maybe once. So this is a snowy day in Jerusalem from this past February. Now, if you're these children and you're in Jenin, which is a city in the northern part of the West Bank, and you awake in the morning, and you have gone through a kind of hell for 2 weeks, not to mention many years of occupation, 35 years of occupation, and you awake in the morning and you look out from your window and this is what you see, and this is after some cleanup has been done. That also shapes how you're looking at the day, that your immediate day, your future, and it also shapes how you feel about the people that, in your view, did that, caused that, brought this to bear. This is in Jenin, where there is a refugee camp, and by refugee camp, you have to understand that we're not talking about, say, a flat field with hundreds or scores of tents. We're talking about a small kind of city that has been built up sort of story by story.
People have been refugees for now going into the fourth generation, since 1948. And so the refugee camps, because this place has been so unsettled, uncertain, the refugee camps have become, you know, their schools, permanent buildings,
so
their
villages. Mm-hmm. That's what these children look out on. There's an area of about 150 yards by 150 yards. Later this week, I'll bring a book that is called, in English, The Earthquake, that shows a lot of what happened last spring 2002, in the West Bank. The Israelis invaded because the rate of suicide bombings, the devastation of suicide bombings, simply was too much. Probably the one that really sparked the invasion was on Passover, when 26, 28 people were killed in a hotel celebrating Passover in Netanya, Israel, on the coast of the Mediterranean. And immediately after that, the Israelis invaded. They were going after what they called nest of terrorists, and so they would come into these refugee camps or into cities.
Which just also, in terms of the refugee situation, the refugee camps themselves have been the places from which most of those who have been suicide bombers have come. They have been living their lives as refugees and are at the last, you know, where all they can do with their anger is explode. At least that's what they think.
Well, it's even more complicated than that.
Of course.
Some people haven't been refugees, and some people are middle class, and the parents don't know why their children did this. But in any case, they came in and they were coming in, they come in very heavily armed. But the Palestinian fighters, not terrorists, fighters, they were resisting an invasion into their city, into their land. Trapped a number of Israeli soldiers, and 23 Israeli soldiers were killed in a firefight in this neighborhood. So the Israelis responded by laying it flat. So the rubble there is about 12 to 15 feet deep. And I can show you pictures later on in the week of people going through that rubble, trying to find belongings. Another thing that we'll talk about this week are checkpoints, and I wanted to show you what a checkpoint looks like. This is at Calandia. That's halfway between Jerusalem and Ramallah. It's at a refugee camp. And you used to be able to drive, well, first of all, there wasn't a checkpoint, and then there was a checkpoint when the Intifada began, but you could still drive through, and sometimes there'd be backups of miles of cars, traffic, 5 lanes in one direction. This is a 2 or 3 lane road. And then eventually, you go away for the summer, and you come back, and you can't drive anymore, and you think, well, that's normal. That's the way it is. What was abnormal, namely checkpoints, it becomes normal. You walk through. So old ladies, old men, mothers carrying children, kids, walk through. And just on the other side there's a refugee camp. So you have kids out. They're throwing rocks at some Israeli soldiers. There's a local airport there. And then the Israeli soldiers shoot back rubber bullets or tear gas. And then there are people selling tomatoes from carts that they push and sort of position themselves midway in the checkpoint. It's a kind of absurd reality that becomes the normal daily reality you expect. And often, when men come up to the checkpoint, they are asked to raise their shirts to show that they are not carrying any bombs. And so what you have on the other side of the checkpoint are hundreds of cars parked for the day and taxis waiting to pick up people that have walked across. That's true in both directions. And the only people going through here are Palestinians. If you're Jewish, you're going down the sort of side road that's in the background that you perhaps can't make out as a road. And you're taking what are called bypass roads, and we'll talk about that too. And Susan mentioned that sometimes you have to argue your way through a checkpoint. And we wanted to show a picture of the bishop that we work with, Bishop Anid Younan of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan. It's called Jordan because when the church was founded in the 1950s, Jordan was the power, was the state that West East Jerusalem was part of. So the old city was part of Jordan. And so they received a royal charter from the king and became an independent church, independent of the German church that had birthed them. So Bishop Anid was the third bishop of the ELCJ. And we were on a delegation to visit some churches in and schools in Ramallah. This is, again, in April 2002, so Ramallah's been under constant curfew and occupation. And Bishop Anid wants to use the system. And he called and received permission from the Israelis for our delegation. We had visitors from the United States to be able to drive through this checkpoint. And it was official permission, but when we got there, somehow the official permission hadn't filtered down to the soldiers manning the checkpoint. And so Bishop Anid had to get out, and this is so typical. I'm sure I've seen him 50 or 60 times doing this, where he's out of the car. He usually has a cell phone in one hand because he's usually calling the district commander, and then he's usually calling some Israeli official in the Ministry of Interior who said he had permission, and then he's usually calling one of our congregational members who works at the U.S. Embassy, the number two person, to talk to her to see if she can call the Israelis. So he's constantly on the phone, he's constantly arguing, and we got through after about 20 minutes. So we've talked a little bit about context and how the context that you live in frames the way that you see reality and helps construct the kinds of hopes you have and also embodies the fears that you have. We're at a checkpoint now leaving Beit Jala, which is a neighboring town to Bethlehem. And that context is surreal, but we accept it as normal. And our son, for an art project, wanted to take the abnormal nature of life in Jerusalem and sort of extend it as far as possible so that we could see its surreal nature. I'm going to go back there, but that was too fast. And suddenly they're droids, or they're what are these people called?
Star troopers.
And the title of this is The Droids We Are Looking For. These are not the droids we are looking for. This is just around the corner from where we live. We live, as I mentioned, on the Mount of Olives, and it's spring. It's so green then. We had a rich rainfall this past spring, and the shepherd has his flock of sheep, and I think there are probably a few goats there. There's the rusted out hulk of a car, and there's trash, but it's beautiful. And he's there, and as our son imagined this picture, he saw another scene, again of a kind of otherworldliness, and that also is part of Jerusalem. But let's go back to Holden. And some of you have seen, where are we right here?
Can you recognize this? It's from here last
year. Yeah, I think we're up in the east and we're looking to the west.
From Martin Ridge, probably.
Yeah, it might be from Martin Ridge. We did that hike.
Looking down into Copper Basin.
Yeah. And then you look and you squint your eyes, and then there's the Dome of the Rock. And so we wanted to try to bring our context here and not have it really merge in, as it does here, into the context of Holden Village, but to have us hold together the various contexts that the realities that inform our life.
We'd like you to understand more about what we have understood. And to do that, we thought it would be helpful just to put forward some of the things that we've understood over the 5 years that we've served in Jerusalem. And the first one being that, as we spoke of, that a grave injustice was done politically to the Palestinian people by the countries of the world through the United Nations in the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. What was restorative justice for a decimated and dispersed Jewish people was a catastrophe, al-Nakba, for the resident Palestinians, who had not been the perpetrators of the Holocaust. And the second thesis, that for those who really care about the future of the State of Israel, and many of us do, a just, both Palestinians and Israelis do care about that, a just peace can be the only way forward. Armed security alone will fail, and Israel will never be free of terrorism. Israel must be a good and valued neighbor if it is to be secure. I think for me, one of the things that was very apparent was that it had not been a good neighbor to the Palestinians in its midst. And that from that not being a good neighbor has risen this resistance and this anger. It's not easy, you know, as we you know, but it's still the case. And then some people, we're often asked, you know, what would it take to have peace there? And as we've listened to Palestinians talk about things, and of course we talk probably more to moderate Palestinians than extremists, but there are more moderate Palestinians than extremists. That first, Israel's return to its 1967 borders. During the 1967 war, the Six-Day War, the borders expanded. And that's this area of the West Bank that is now illegal, that is now occupied. And to share Jerusalem as capital of not just Israel, but of whatever Palestinian state emerges. Second, to recognize the right of the return for refugees, those who were removed from their homes at the establishment of Israel. And then we've quoted that most Palestinians at this point are pretty realistic and realize that they can't most likely return to their homes. That's just not going to be where their life is now. Many have moved all over the world. But then there should be a compensation from the State of Israel if they do not choose to return. And third, acknowledgement by Israel that a great wrong has been done to the Palestinian people as a byproduct of the creation of the State of Israel. And this is so important, as you recall from the sermon last night, some of what Maury was saying about what's happened in South Africa and how important the truth and reconciliation process there, where people have actually been able to say, we did something wrong here, and confess that, and to ask for ways to go forward now. But there really has not been any acknowledgement on the part of Israel officially that anything has happened to the Palestinian people. So that's Palestinians certainly would have some things to confess as well. We wanted to go through some of the quickly the maps of Israel and the area. Michael, are you prepared to be involved in this? Okay.
This is a map that these maps are copied by permission from the author, a friend of ours, Alex Awad, and we will try to put out a bibliography, or we will try to actually get email addresses from you and send you a bibliography, and we'll send around a sheet in just a moment. And he does a very nice primer of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. This is a map by a Zionist organization envisioning a future state of Israel, or state of Jewish state. And I don't have a citation on it, so I can't refer you. But essentially, it's everything from Amman to the west, from the Jordan River. In other words, it's what's understood as biblical Israel.
And this is 1919. Yeah. This is somebody's idea of a Zionist idea of what it would be good to have.
But it was still called Palestine.
They were calling it Palestine.
Yes,
at the time.
When you go, many tourists, both Jews and non-Jews, buy as a tourist souvenir in all the gift shops. You can see this wonderful picture, sort of a watercolor of the old city of Jerusalem, and it says, "Visit Palestine," and so. People in our congregation, it was on everyone's living room wall framed, had it. And what you had to look for in the small print was that it was put out by a Zionist organization. It was the Palestinian Zionist Jewish Tourist Board, something like that. And so they were inviting people to come and visit. That was in the 1930s. And then what's very interesting, after World War I, you probably know that the British were given the mandate by the League of Nations to rule over Palestine and find an acceptable solution to the conflict between Jews and Arabs. And so this is their attempt at a kind of solution. Keep in mind that the Jewish population is much smaller. I believe it's about, at this time in 1937, it's about 28%. And I'm sure I'm not more than a few percentage points off in terms of what the Jewish population was. And the Arab population then was 72, or maybe it was even more.
Less, I think that the Jewish population was less.
Maybe less. And the Arabs owned about 94% of the land at that time. And so what you have here is a relatively large Arab state, a relatively small proposed Jewish state, and then, like colonialists everywhere, the best is reserved for the people in power. I mean, it's not really, I mean, it's also beautiful up in the north and in the south, but Jerusalem is kept separate.
It's green passage and to the Mediterranean.
And then there's a direct connection to the Mediterranean.
So this was, again, a proposal, a partition plan.
1937. Okay, then note the date there, 1947. Note the change in relative sizes of proposed states. And so what happened in that 10-year period from 1937 to 1947?
World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And the Holocaust. And the Jewish suffering and tragedy, the Shoah, as it's called in Hebrew, and European and American guilt, that we did not stop what happened in time. And so out, I think, out of, many others think, out of that guilt, there was seen to be, well, there was a mandate to try to do things right by the Jewish people. And on one hand, then they take the European problem, that context, and they shift it to the Middle East. And in a sense, no one, it wasn't that Europe was trying to in any way welcome back Jews and to create a place for Jews, though there was a Zionist proposal to use southern Germany as a Jewish state. Mm-hmm. Many Jews, German Jews, felt entirely at home in German culture. They felt German first. They had served in World War I, and so that was one reason why it was so inexplicable to them what had happened. Because how could it happen when they were what they felt to be fully enculturated in German society? So the Arab state is much smaller, and the Jewish state is larger. But again, Jerusalem is separated out. It's what was called a corpus separatum, a separate body, and it was meant to be a kind of international city. And there you also see the Arabic name for Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Then we have the war for independence, as it's called in Israel, and you can see that the Israelis, now that the United Nations designated them a state, established that state, and you can see that they have more land than before. The scale is different on this map.
What year is that?
This is from 1967, isn't it? The occupied West Bank of Gaza,
1948. No,
this one.
Yeah.
It says
67.
Okay.
No,
it
shows the area.
Well, that 67 is referring to just the dark red area. Is there another number up there on the second line that's kind of fuzzy?
Yeah, 1948. It's the armistice line, and it's hard. It's almost impossible to see on this projection.
Is your focus good on that?
Let's see if we can.
So the map on the right, is that what actually happened in 48?
No.
Those were proposals. This is what happened.
Okay.
This is not in 48. This is 67.
Well, there's another map that shows. This is what this map is going to be.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll move ahead here and go to the next map, which we hope is a little less confusing. Okay.
Upside down. And something just to quickly note, all those that map that looks like it has a case of the measles, those are all villages that were Arab villages, and those villages have disappeared. They have just disappeared. In some cases, people were frightened, and often justly so, of what Israelis, what the soldiers would do in the various fighting forces for Israel would do, and so they fled. In other cases, inhabitants were killed, either in large numbers or small numbers, but the message was gotten across that they needed to leave. In many cases, most of the Arabs thought they'd be able to come back, and that, of course, after all these years, has proved impossible. No refugee from the state of no refugee from the state of Israel 1948 has ever been allowed back. Keep in mind that Jews from anywhere in the world are granted immediate citizenship upon entry into Israel if they can prove their Jewish identity. So in many of these places, you might ask, what happened to these villages, or what do they look like? In some cases, there are beautiful woods. There were all these years of planting trees in the state of Israel. And in many cases, these old villages are planted over with beautiful pine groves. And you wouldn't know, there's no marker, there's no memorial. Here stood a Palestinian Arab village from 1948. Nothing. Or the villages have been taken over by Israelis. So one of our good friends lives in Ramla, which is halfway between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and she lives in an Arab house. And that's an amazing story. We'll tell you a little bit about that house later in the week.
Occupied area of Lebanon.
Yeah, and the Golan Heights that belong to Syria. And so what's helpful to note from this map is that even though the Palestinians were by far the majority in Palestine in 1947 and owned the vast majority of land, after the war and after 67, they now have 22% of the land, and Israel has 78% of the land. And the Palestinians, the majority of Palestinians, say they are willing to settle, to accept 22% of the land for their statehood, if they can be assured that it's a viable state, a state that can survive, that has meaningful sovereignty. On the other side, Israel is concerned that no, that's just, they'll just begin there. And then we know that they hate us, and then we know that they'll try to push us into the sea. And what's striking, one of the things that comes out of that thinking is that that's exactly what Jews were thinking about when they were negotiating with Britain and with the United Nations. Ben-Gurion talked about if they could just get a foothold of a state, they could expand. And they were always pragmatic, and they're always exceptional negotiators. And
you see here now what has happened in terms of footholds.
So after 67, the Minister of Housing, Ariel Sharon, that we know now today as the Prime Minister, was one of the leading architects in what's called the settlement for colonization, as Palestinians prefer to term it, the settlement of the West Bank. And for the most part, these settlements are very carefully planned in terms of military and water and other natural resources. And so they look small. But one of the concepts.
All these different colors, the green and the red and the.
Are Jewish settlements
in the West Bank.
And probably the biggest one.
Occupied territories.
There are two things you need to, more than two things. There are at least three things you need to understand. Most Israelis have no idea what the West Bank is like. Okay? They don't know.
What is the West Bank?
The West Bank is everything here that's in this.
West of the Jordan River. That's why it's called the West Bank. See where the Jordan River is?
The Jordan River runs here. It separates the country of Jordan from Israel, Palestine. And there are about 400,000 settlers. Since the Oslo peace process began, that increased somewhere between 100 and 200,000. That wasn't supposed to happen, but it did. And that illustrates one of the prime defects in the Oslo peace process. There was no enforcement mechanism. So if you live in Haifa, you really don't know very much about the West Bank. If you're one of the 200,000 colonizers or settlers that live around Jerusalem and Mali Adumim, it's like a suburb. You don't have any sense that you've gone into a foreign land.
But you see how Jerusalem is really surrounded by these settlements in the Palestinian area. So what there's been is this is this pretty concentrated effort to ring Jerusalem with settlements so that it really is cut off from any Palestinian state.
There's a huge settlement swath that goes through here. And so Bethlehem is now being encircled with a fence. But the other thing you need to understand is that even though the vast amount of land seems to be Palestinian on this map, which you see these sort of dots and small areas, a colleague of ours, Jeff Halper, who's from Minnesota but immigrated to Israel, he's Jewish, he's an academician at the Hebrew University as well. He talks about a matrix of control. That imagine a prison, for instance, that you have, 4,000 prisoners, and I don't know what number of guards you would have, security you would have, but it doesn't take, you just need nodules, you just need certain small critical areas within a prison complex in order to control the entire prison. The prisoners have more or less the run of the prison. You need small critical areas to control whatever happens within that prison. And that is what is done here. Bypass roads have been made, have been constructed through the West Bank so that Israelis do not have to go through Palestinian cities. And so when you build a road, imagine a two-lane road. You can imagine that taking 60 feet. But instead it takes about 300 yards to 400 yards because there's always a security belt around it. And you have it all the way through. And then these places are almost always built on aquifers where they have ready access to water. One thing we didn't talk about last week was water. That is one of the critical issues. So when you go to Bethlehem, when we would visit congregation members in Bethlehem in the summer, often they would not have water for a week or sometimes longer. They could look out their window at settlements and see a green, verdant oasis with a swimming pool. And that is the amount of water that Palestinians receive is much, much less than what, and the Israelis control that. Much less, yes?
When do settlements actually happen? I mean, logistically, do they take certain families that kind of...
Oh, they happen rather unofficially, but with benevolent negligence on the part of the Israeli government. So people will go out and put out a house trailer and maybe a little bit more. And then next thing you know, there's a water and power kind of tower going up, and then it just expands. And it may be important to understand how this happens in people, why Israel thinks that they can do this, just to realize that at the time that Jordan was in charge of these, this was part of Jordan's territory. They had begun, and in the north, to register the ownership of the lands. And they got about a quarter of the way through, and the rest was unregistered. At the time of the 67 war, there were lots of old documents and oral remembrance of who owned what land. But the official writing down had only been completed to about a quarter of the way.
Now, Jordan was going sort of down the West Bank trying to do a proper land registry.
Yeah.
And when
the 67 war happened, Israel just decided it was all public land, that the land was public. And so that's why settlers think they can go out and just camp on somebody's land.
Yeah, Sharon set the grabs every hilltop you can in 1998. Let me point out two other details. Imagine we're looking at sort of the biblical swath of geography here, and you've come out of Egypt, captive Egypt, and you've crossed into the Sinai, and down here is the mountain that Moses received the Ten Commandments, and your people wander and wander and make their way. And all the cities that you read about in the Bible, they're right in this swamp. Right there. They're not, Tel Aviv is a new city. There was nothing there when Moses looked towards the promised land or Isaiah lived. There was nothing. There were sand dunes. Gaza is an ancient biblical area as well. And look who has them. So if you are a religious Zionist Jew, you know, where do you want to live? And the other thing to, I think, be aware of is that you have a lot of settlers that are just in need of housing. They know that they can have superior housing with more amenities if they live on a settlement for far less than they could afford in the state of Israel.
Because they are subsidized.
Yeah, they're great subsidization.
And so in 48, I'm sorry to be so slow. In 48, the yellow section, map 6, that's established by the UN as the state of Israel. The West Bank is under control of Jordan.
It was actually called the Trans-Jordan. Because it crossed, so that map doesn't go back to 48.
Okay. But it's the red area is, it's not a separate, is it a separate state?
No.
Officially? Never.
No,
so it's always been a dispute.
That's what will be, that's what Israel calls it. They call it disputed land rather than territory or occupied land, because occupation has certain legal requirements for the occupying power, and Israel does not want to recognize that, and so they refer to it as disputed land.
And Palestinians refer to it as
illegally occupied territory.
Well, under whose control? Their own?
No, under Israel's control.
Yeah. Did the UN set up that Israeli control of the, Palestinian territory?
No. They became as... Since they were the victors, they became the occupiers, and then under international law, they have responsibilities as occupiers for medical, food, and educational activities, which they haven't engaged in, certainly haven't engaged in for the last 10 years. And now they're reoccupying the West Bank, and they're formally not responding as a occupied power.
Why was it broken off from Jordan? Who did that?
Jordan renounced any territorial claim in order to move the peace process along. Jordan also historically was not really that interested in Jerusalem. And it was sort of Jerusalem during the period in which Jordan was the sovereign power wasn't particularly interested in Jerusalem, and it was sort of a backwater. Yes?
Can you kind of review the 1967 war? How that came about and who the players were.
Well,
this was something I intended to pass out. I'm sorry.
Oh, yes, we have this timeline.
Yeah, this is something you should have had in your hand so you could get a little outline of that history.
So Palestinians would like to have their own state, but they don't.
Yes.
Israel could occupy it officially, but it's not taking responsibility to do so.
No, it's not to occupy it officially. It should not be occupying it officially.
So it's just supposed to be floating there?
See, what I meant, I probably was confusing. There are lots of Israeli soldiers and military structures in the West Bank. They are the occupiers. They captured that land, and as occupiers, as victors in a sense, they have responsibilities under international law for the civilian population there. They have not accepted that responsibility. And of course, the civilians there want to have their own state, the Palestinian state. And so what is in question are the borders, and questions about refugees, questions about water rights, and essentially questions about viability as a state.
And who was the last legitimate responsible political entity to control that territory?
Transjordan.
Transjordan. Yeah.
Michael, this is going back a ways, but I just had a question about in 1948, and even since then, if the world powers, it sounds like from what you say, were very motivated by this guilt from what had happened to the Jews in World War II. But were there other like political and economic factors that caused them to move ahead, and what would those have been?
Well, one is called the Suez Canal. That was certainly an issue. Back in the 19th century, you have the French, the Germans, and the English that were the primary players that were trying to maneuver for political power. And you have what was called the sick man of Europe, the Ottoman Empire, which was on its last legs and finally expired in World War I. Oil then became an important, beginning in the 20th century, became an important consideration for world powers. Could you hear me? Susan said,
yeah.
I wasn't speaking loud enough. And then the other great, I should say, first of all, I'm not a historian. We're trying to get
specialists on this.
You had also the clash of communism and quote, the free world also. And so various nations, Arabs were generally aligned very much with Russia, the Soviet Union. Israel was our sort of base in the Middle East. And so everything got played out with that context in mind. Then things changed, of course, then with the demise of the Soviet Union. And then that aspect became less, but then you had the rise of military Islam at approximately the same time. But you've had the Palestinian movement since the 1930s.
What's that movement?
What do you mean, Michael, what?
What's the Palestinian movement?
Well, people that lived there were never really consulted about what the agreements that were being made between them and various Jewish organizations in other countries. And so they felt aggrieved, and they were worried that their society, their culture, their way of life would disappear with the entry of large numbers of Jews into Palestine, and even more worried with the rise of a Jewish Israeli state.
We are at the end of our time, and didn't get to the roadmap part. I think visually it's important also to keep this map in mind. Just the idea that you've got these. This is an Oslo Accord map, where I hope what you're seeing is this kind of continual historical shrinking of space that Palestinians feel like the world is saying you have some control over. And these pink areas were areas largely, I mean, it was divided in other A, B, and C frames, but these pink areas were the areas that were under Palestinian civil and religious and military control. The pink areas. So you see what has happened now in the West Bank is we're getting a kind of Swiss cheese idea that you've got Ariel Sharon's idea basically is that you can have Palestinian state in the large cities of the West Bank, and that somehow there would be some road between them so they could get to one another. But those roads, of course, would be controlled by Israel. And then there would be Gaza over here, again with a road that has already been built that would connect these things. So the idea is that he sort of has in mind in this whole process is this kind of non-connected, non-contiguous state that's going to be very, very weak and hardly viable.
So I think we'll have to come back to the roadmap. Maybe
but just to get in your mind this shrinking, shrinking, shrinking.
And let me just give you a couple of statistics from Gaza. Gaza, I mentioned, was an ancient civilization, so you can find in major museums of archaeology, of Middle Eastern archaeology, you can find examples, Egyptian coffins and so on, 5,000 years ago here. Anyway, there are 1 million Palestinians that live in this area. There are 5,000 Israeli colonizers that live here. The Israelis have the blue areas. You can see they're fairly large. You don't have trouble seeing this area. There are only 5,000 in all of that area. They control the water resources. The water in Gaza is terrible. It's essentially undrinkable water and also harms the agriculture there. And 1 million Palestinians in here. And there's a prison they can't leave.
Is this the series going to be going through the week?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll try to take you through. We'll try to help you understand various aspects, and then try to talk about what can be our response. And probably the first is simply to educate ourselves, and then maybe the second is to pray about this, to lift up the Palestinian and Jewish peoples for God's care and mercy and wisdom. And then also to mobilize and to lobby and to act and to even protest. And there are lots of ways that this can be done. But to educate yourself and to lift up these peoples before God are probably the two most important initial things we can do.
The next section is tomorrow night at 6:20. Tomorrow evening at 6:20. And if you come, bring your IDs.
Hey, I would ask that you control questions so that you can get your agenda covered and not run out of time.
Okay, we'll take that into consideration.
There's a lot to cover, and we apologize.
Yeah, it is a really hard thing to try to.
And we didn't even show the video because the video
wasn't working.
Projector isn't working.
Can I make one little comment?
Sure.
I think it's important for all of us to know that we are intimately connected to what's happening there because it's our tax money. A ton, thousands and millions.
It's about $3
billions
million
of dollars. Of our taxes, our foreign aid, biggest percentage is going over to Israel, not the Palestinians. We are the ones who are building these settlements over there. And I just want everyone to know that.
Let me just clarify, though. We're not building, our tax dollars aren't going to build settlements. What happens is that the Israelis receive our funds and they're able then to divert their own financial resources to, therefore, to build the settlements.
But it's our money, and so we have to say it.
And a lot of Christian money, too, is directly going to settlements. Money contributed by Christians in congregations in the United States.
Not from the ELCA. The ELCA has
not from essentially mainline churches, yeah, but from evangelical and we'll talk about Christian Zionist churches.
So thank you.
Thank you.